Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be those of Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who is the American commander of the coalition forces in Iraq from June of 2003. To June of 2004. General Sanchez, thank you very much for being with us.
Absolutely, sir. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, I think your book is so important, and, of course, your talk that you gave last October was really, of course, was a key to my understanding what was going on over there, and we did reproduce that in one of our newsletters. But certainly the book you've written, Wiser in Battle, is an effort to really tell not only your background, but then, of course, what really happened when you were in command over there. And of course, in many respects, it was very, very difficult for the American forces. And what the point you made, which I thought was so interesting, was that immediately after the president announced that mission accomplished there, I guess about the 1st of May of 2003, well, then they started pulling all the troops out, and you were going to be left with a force that was really hardly adequate at all to deal with the problems. Would you like to pick up the story and tell our listeners what you encountered?
Yes, sir, absolutely. I think what's important for us to understand as a nation is that by the 1st of May of 2003, the senior military and political leadership of our nation have already made the determination and the assessments that the war is over, and that America can, in fact, turn itself away from that war and get on to other issues. The result is what's important for us to understand, and that is that we abandon the forces on the ground. We immediately begin to dismantle the headquarters that are in place, both at the General Franks level and at the next level down, the headquarters that had been fighting the war at the operational level. And it leaves a staff, my headquarters, on the ground that is not properly trained and not properly resourced to begin to cope with the aftermath of major combat operations. And probably also just as important is the fact that the orders have already been issued by the nation to withdraw our forces and get us down to a level of less than 30,000 by the end of August.
So they were pulling your men out. They were actually, of course, bringing in the coalition forces, and they didn't want to be there in any sort of a combat situation. And yet, of course, after Mr. Paul Bremer arrived and issued a number of, I think, rather ill-advised orders there would supersede the generals, the military. Why then, of course, when they certainly did not reorganize the army or get the police force back, or they had the civil service was pretty well let go in the depathification. You were really facing a civil war, weren't you?
Sir, absolutely. I think what you've mentioned is really important for us to understand what happens to Iraq in the May time frame when Ambassador Bremer comes in and issues the depathification and the disbanding of the army order. Those two orders combined, in and of themselves, are probably well-intentioned, but the way that we implement them is what really creates a significant problem for the coalition and for the forces that are trying to stabilize the country.
But if you'd had an attacked army and police force and civil service, wouldn't you, of course, really have been able to maintain the order and stability there?
Well, absolutely, and I think that was exactly what the military had intended to do, was to bring all of that capacity to bear in trying to stabilize the country. But when you eliminated every single Baathist that had ever been a member of the party from their jobs, so bureaucrats, technocrats, and all civil servants, that really created a tremendous vacuum and a problem for the coalition.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment for Lieutenant General Sanchez. We're dropping some stations, bringing some other stations on. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. He's retired from the military, but he was the commander of the coalition forces in Iraq from June of 2003 to June of 2004. And, of course, our listeners will remember that the president declared an ultimate victory, mission accomplished, in May, 1st of May of the year 2003. And so then they began pulling all of the American troops out. They were going to leave 30,000 American troops in Iraq. They were bringing in the coalition forces, who certainly didn't want to be fighting in a civil war or any sort of military. They were just sort of there as peacekeeping or for stability purposes. And suddenly General Sanchez finds himself, because Paul Bremer had come in, and Paul Bremer, sent from the United States, is who actually was able to supersede in authority the commanding general. And what does Paul Bremer do? Paul Bremer says, we've got to actually eliminate anybody who's ever been a member of the Baathist Party. It's sort of like saying, well, we don't like the Republicans here. No Republican can hold office anywhere in the United States or in the military or police force. And I guess we think they've done a point. Well, you know, could imagine what would happen to the United States tomorrow. So basically, this is, of course, what happened. They didn't have a military. They didn't have a police force. They didn't have a civil service. In fact, Paul Bremer had even ordered the schools shut down, didn't he?
Yes, sir. That is exactly correct. Every function of government and society is incapable of continuing to serve the people because of the de-Baathification order.
And, of course, this meant that the high school students couldn't graduate. The students couldn't graduate from the semester, and it was bad enough to have a war. But then suddenly the kids can't go to school. And you did something you probably could have gotten in trouble for, couldn't you, because you actually just went ahead and said, ignore the order?
Yes, sir. We were getting that from across the entire country, since we were the military was the only one that had presence across the entire country of Iraq, and the very first plea from the Iraqi people was for us to reestablish their education system so that they would not lose an entire year, and we went ahead and did exactly that in spite of the de-Baathification orders.
There's no electricity or very little electricity, or very little water, clean water. The thing is becoming increasingly chaotic. Of course, they've closed down a lot of the government-operated factories. You got all these people out of work, and didn't a lot of these people then turn to the revolutionary movement just because it was the only way they could feed their families?
Well, what happens to us is through the de-Baathification order, we essentially disenfranchise a very, very large segment of the population.
Hold that for just a moment, please.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and General Sanchez is just talking about the de-Baathification order that Paul Bremer issued, that is sort of certainly actually disenfranchised almost everyone in the Sunni population, not almost everybody, but certainly everybody had a government job, and most of them just had, they belonged to the Baath Party because it was the only way you could get along when Saddam was in power. But most of them were not criminals at all. They were simply doing what was expedient. They joined the ruling party to get ahead. So what happens at this point when suddenly, of course, the order is out, nobody who's been a member of the Baathist Party can hold any sort of a government job? So doesn't this really create tremendous resentment on the part of the Sunni Muslims?
Well, absolutely. What it does to us, in effect, on the ground, is immediately we start to have demonstrations by former military, former security force people, and just former Baathist employees that now have absolutely no means of supporting their families. Even retired personnel's pensions have been cut off. And it takes us weeks, actually in some cases months, to be able to reestablish those, and it takes some hard negotiations with the ambassador to reinstate payments to the Iraqi military. And for a long period of time, we continue to sow the seeds of anger and the potential for joining the insurgency on the part of former Baptists.
And then, so wasn't the insurgency really sort of initially the disenfranchised members of the Baptist Party, you know, never anticipated they would, they didn't want to get rid of Saddam. A lot of them wanted to get rid of Saddam, but of course when they got rid of Saddam, it meant that they lost their jobs, they lost their factory jobs, their government jobs, their, even some of the hospitals, I understand, were closed down because there were Baptists working in them.
Well, exactly. It was every function of society was shut down for a period of time until we started to bring them back. But I think beyond the economic impact, we also have a complete loss of political hope for the Sunni segment of society. Part of the de-identification forbids them from holding public office until they could go through the exemption processes. That were never fully implemented on the part of the Coalition Provisional Authority, and that continues to create resentment over the course of the summer.
And of course, really, Chris, it's the Sunni were the majority, and they wanted to get back into power. They hadn't had any power, and since they were beginning to get all the positions of power, and the Sunnis became second-class citizens, and was there tremendous resentment there on the part of the Sunnis towards the Shias?
Well, absolutely. What it did is it highlighted the age-old differences between the two groups, and in fact, the Shia, as they assumed power, they became very draconian once they assumed control of the de-Ba'athification, and they were adamant about refusing any sort of reintegration on the part of the Ba'athists across any segment of society. And that continued to aggravate the Sunni population.
What about the Christians there? Because, of course, there's an age-old Celtic and Christian population that's been there for 2,000 years. My understanding is that they came under tremendous pressure, and, of course, most of the Christians there fled because of the American invasion and destabilization of the society.
Yes, sir. It exposed them to increased harassment, and in some cases we had direct attacks on the Christian population that was present in the country. In essence, they got caught in between the Shia and the Sunnis, they did, in fact, wind up having to seek refuge in other places.
So it's really just a totally unstable country. Well, I'd like you to tell a few of the stories that you tell in your book. One about, of course, the attack on Fallujah, where, of course, you as a military man and with your forces wanted to go in and win and wipe out the rebel or the terrorist element there. And would you want to tell that story? Because I thought it was an amazing story, not the story we got here in America at all. And people, why don't you give the background of Fallujah?
Yes, sir. When the incident occurs that America and the world saw in terms of the mutilation and desecration of the four Blackwater contractors. From a military commander standpoint on the ground, that was a tactical action that had very little strategic significance as far as our security situation was concerned. But as those pictures flashed across the world, the situation back in Washington was such that the administration had to do something, and it had to be done rather rapidly in order to be able to address this now very complex problem that we were facing. The answer was that we would conduct offensive operations into Fallujah within a matter of days. And the timing was wrong. The Marines on the ground had just assumed control and were not prepared to conduct those offensive operations, but once we were directed to go ahead and begin the planning, it was very clear in the decision processes that it would take us 3 to 4 weeks to accomplish the mission. It would be very a very bloody and tough fight, and that we would have significant problems with Al Jazeera reporters that were on the ground. And if directed, we could execute the operation in very short timelines, but our preference was not to execute it and delay. But the order was given to go ahead and initiate the offensive.
And so this was not a military decision. This was a political decision. We're going to look good. We're going to do something about Fallujah. I mean, certainly it was a tragedy when the four American Blackwater employees were actually killed there and burned, the bodies burned and hung up from a bridge. But now we're going to attack the whole city in reprisal for that. And most of the people there, I simply had nothing to do with it. I'm sure there were some radicals there in the city. But then you're all set to go. You attack, and then you're really doing great. You're doing a great job. You're doing what the military does, and then you're ordered to stop. I mean,
yes,
and then you're ordered to retreat in the face of just about to be victorious, and now you're suddenly ordered from Washington, D.C. to defeat, to retreat. This is not a military decision. Once again, it's a political decision.
Yes, sir. What happens to us is as we are preparing to go into Fallujah, it is very clear that there is a military requirement in Fallujah that has to be accomplished at some point, but not at that point in time. Because we know that there's a safe haven in Fallujah, and we prefer to delay that offensive. But once we're given the order, we launch with our Marine and Army forces, and within a matter of literally hours, the Iraqi Governing Council begins to collapse around the ambassador, and he's working literally 20 to 22 hours a day trying to maintain the integrity of that, and we begin to get significant pressure from our coalition partners and the United Nations representative on the ground to stop the offensive, and the decision is made to stop. And the order that is given to me by Ambassador Bremer is to withdraw immediately from Fallujah when we are engaged essentially across the entire front. And our assessment at that point is that we have probably 4 days left before we can complete the mission.
And of course, what will happen if you pull out, you know, I mean, you didn't want to go in the first place, but now if you pull out, America's going to look like pretty much a paper tiger, isn't it?
Well, absolutely, and that was the basis for my refusing to issue that order, because withdrawing under fire would have been a catastrophic strategic defeat for our coalition and specifically for the American military. And when I refused to issue that order between General Abizaid, Ambassador Bremer, and me, we come up with a compromise, and the compromise is that we will just stop offensive operations. In the end, as you look back, I think history shows us that the end result in the long term was basically the same as having withdrawn under fire, because it strengthened the insurgency, and we really set the seeds for a much greater level of violence than we had experienced before, and one could, in fact, make a case for a possible increase in stability had we completed that mission.
Yeah, but you weren't allowed to, and that was the case. And I reading your book, I could feel your frustration. And of course, the same thing was true of the Mahdi army. And for the listeners out there, this was a separate private army that some fellow named, and I can never pronounce his name, but his last name is called Al-Sidr. He actually, and this was his private army. He was one of the religious leaders over there. He's the fellow you always see with the black turban on. And he has this private army, and you cannot maintain stability in a country with a private army there. So you want to go ahead and get rid of him, because that's the logical thing to do. If we're going to have an orderly society, you can't have, a private army, but 10,000, 15,000 men. How large was that army? Do you have any idea?
Well, it was definitely, we believe it was greater than 5,000. We were not exactly sure how many he had enlisted, but we knew that he could generate popular support in the tens of thousands with a call to arms.
Sure.
And our challenge with Muqtada al-Sadr was that he had been a problem for the coalition since the late summer of 2003. And the decision is made in the spring of 2004, in the late March, early April time frame, that we're going to either kill or capture him. And those missions are assigned and approved at the level of the president. And right on the verge of executing the mission, once again, our political leadership decides that we're going to back away from that mission. And it sets the conditions where we could for what we continue to struggle with today.
And of course, there were several times when actually we're going to go after Al-Sadr, and of course, each time you're blocked from doing what was logical to try to create a stable country. Would that be correct?
Yes, sir. And to be absolutely fair, there are three different times when the opportunity arises for Muqtada al-Sadr, and the first time in the late July and August of 2003 time frame, the military is not prepared because our coalition partners are in the process of occupying the sector in the south, and we recommend that we not execute. But in November of 2003, we're prepared and ready to execute, and because of the decisions to transfer sovereignty, a political decision is made that we're to stand down and not execute, and then it happens to us again in the spring of 2004.
Hold that thought, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. We're really talking about the frustration that General Sanchez really felt, as, of course, as he's over there trying to do a good job. The military is trying to do a good job. The military is performing very, very well. But time and again, they're, of course, being blocked by political decisions that prevent them from effectively winning the war. Well, then, of course, do you want to talk a little bit about Abu Ghraib? Because this was an unfortunate situation, and, of course, you were made the sort of the brunt of this. Whereas, of course, it was not even under your command. Wasn't that true?
Well, sir, yes. What happens to us as a country is that in 2002, when the administration issues its policies that eliminate the Geneva Conventions, that essentially puts America and our forces on the path towards abuse and torture. And when we couple that with the fact that the American military, and specifically my Army, do not issue any implementing instructions, no safeguards, they provide no training to our interrogators and our military policemen and our soldiers for executing this new policy, it just sets the conditions for abuse to happen. And in fact, it happens to America in the November-December of 2002 timeframe when two prisoners that are being interrogated in Afghanistan are killed. And the results of those investigations establish that, in fact, we have some significant problems with interrogations and detention operations. And all of the findings from that incident are replicated again in the aftermath of Abu Ghraib. But at Abu Ghraib, what really happens to us is that we have a confluence of three different agencies or entities that are operating as the conventional forces, which I command, that I control, and that are operating under the Geneva Conventions. And there are two others that are operating in there, the Special Operations and the CIA, who I do not control, and they are not operating under the Geneva Conventions. They're still conducting their interrogations in accordance with the policies established in 2002. And it's that confusion that comes from having those three entities there and the results of their interrogations that wind up getting commingled with the abuse of criminal detainees by my military policemen. Military policemen, in fact, abuse detainees, but none of those detainees that are shown naked in the photographs were ever scheduled for or interrogated because they were not security detainees. They had been detainees that had rioted, and therefore the military policemen were punishing them for that in the pictures that the whole world is aware of.
Why in heaven's name would they have taken those pictures, the most ridiculous thing in the world, and why were those pictures ever released to the public?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. I think what had been happening in that organization is that over the course of the war, they had pictures that stretched back to the ground war days, where they had been that small group of military policemen had just been documenting and then their activities. And the actual release, I think it was just a matter of time from when we first learned of the incident in about the 13th of January. We knew that those pictures would at some point be released, and we knew the gravity of the situation. And within a matter of about 36 hours, we have the confessions of some of the military.
Hold that thought, please. Well, this is Dr. Stad. I guess Lieutenant General Carlos Sanchez, and he was pointing out, we were talking about Abu Ghraib and the torture, you know, or the mistreatment of prisoners that went on there. And General Sanchez is simply pointing out that it was in 2002 that the administration announced we were not going to abide by the Geneva Convention. But of course, the military under General Sanchez was operating under the Geneva Convention, but the other groups, and specifically at Abu Ghraib, there was the Special Forces units, and then there was the CIA, were not operating under the Geneva Convention, so it's just nothing but confusion. The military policemen who were involved with the sexual humiliation and mistreatment of the prisoners, and none of these prisoners were apparently to be questioned. They were all criminals. The military police were did what they did because they tried to riot, and one of them had a gun, and of course this was sort of to punish everybody. But of course, the fact that they took the pictures and then they said, but this really had nothing to do with questioning at all, did it?
No, sir. Not a single one of those prisoners that are abused by the military policemen was ever questioned or was ever interrogated, rather.
Well, no, sort of, were the military police under your command, or were they under a separate command?
The military police, they are under my, what we term, tactical control, and they were responsible for the detention operations in the prison.
But then, of course, there were the other units there, the CIA and the...
Yes, sir, the CIA and the Special Operations Forces are not under my command. They report back to the Special Operations Forces, report back to their headquarters under Special Operations Command, the National Special Operations Command, and through General Abizaid at Central Command. And the CIA notionally reports back to the ambassador in the country and then back to CIA headquarters. And it was their operations that episodically during the year that I was there, we would receive allegations of abuse, and those would be reported through their chains of command for resolution. And of course, they had no requirement to report back to me whatever outcomes they established.
And of course, the thing is that here you had then have a divided command. Isn't that sort of laying out a blueprint for all sorts of confusion and disruption?
Well, absolutely, and not having what we term unity of command, where the commander on the ground controls all those elements, is in fact a recipe for some significant problems on the ground. But I think that was just another extension of the greater challenges that we had been facing from the time that 1 May set the conditions for how we were going to execute our operations in the country.
Well, then what about General Tsukuba? General Tsukuba came in, and he was a major general. He was actually assigned the task of investigating what happened at Abu Ghraib. And what was the background of that?
Well, the background of Tony's investigation is that as soon as I am briefed on the incident, within about 24 hours of the discovery of the incident, I request an investigation and an investigating team to be conducted by General McKiernan's headquarters, which is the headquarters that is responsible for the military policemen, because I don't have authority to conduct those investigations over those military policemen. So Tony Tsukuba is assigned as the investigating officer, and he comes in and conducts a very thorough, objective, and frank investigation of what is going on within the military policemen and within Abu Ghraib.
And what was his conclusion then?
Well, basically was that, in fact, there had been some significant abuses that were going on, that there was a significant breakdown in the leadership and the command inside of the military police brigade, and that we had a commander that was considerably challenged and unwilling to accept the fact that her soldiers had committed some abuses.
And of course, then she did not immediately relieve her of command because she was about ready to rotate home. Was that it?
Right. Well, what happens in that decision is that one has to understand that when these abuses occur, the senior military policeman in the Army, Major General Don Ryder, is in Abu Ghraib conducting an assessment that was based on my request for assistance from the Army. He comes in with a team of 40 detention experts to assess our operations and to help us in conducting those operations. And he makes the recommendation that we not relieve her because the Army could not support getting us a replacement in time.
So then,
and I agree to that.
All right, fine. But then, of course, that is used as a means of criticizing you later on down the line, even though, of course, it was really, she was going home very, very soon, and that would have left her unit without any command.
Absolutely. She was due to rotate out of the country in less than 3 weeks.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. And please go ahead and tell the story from there, General Sanchez.
Yes, sir. And the issue with Don Ryder is that he makes a recommendation that we not relieve Janice Karpinski because she's due to rotate within a matter of about 3 weeks. And, in fact, I have the advanced party for the unit that's going to replace him. Replace her organization already in the country at that time. And part of the rationale for my not relieving her at that point is that I had been asking the Army for a senior colonel or a brigadier general with MP background for at least 5 months at that point to come in and help us run detention operations, and they had not provided us with any assistance at all.
So if you knew, if you believed her, you wouldn't have nobody in command. That would have been the tragedy.
Exactly.
And the thing that that disturbed me so much reading her book was the fact that you never had enough personnel. I mean, most of us think of the United States Army, all these men out there, but time and time again you mentioned the fact that there just were not that many units that could be actually be deployed there in Iraq, and you had a terrible time getting personnel or adequate personnel to really do what you had to do.
Yes, sir. I think it becomes clear when one looks very objectively at the status of the American military in the summer of 2003 that there was insufficient capacity at the national level for us to sustain force deployment levels in Iraq at any level greater than 135,000 to 140,000. And if we were to go beyond that, then we could not sustain it for an indefinite period of time. It would be for very short periods, sort of what we've done with the surge over the course of the last year. But in order to sustain long-term deployments, we couldn't go above that level. And I think what's also important during the first 6 to 8 months of my command is that we are trying to stabilize and turn around the orders that General Franks had issued in the April time frame to withdraw all of the forces. What that did in reality is that it stopped any force rotation planning on the part of the Army, and therefore there were no plans in place for us to cycle out the units that had been deployed or that were coming up on a one-year deployment. And that created significant problems for our reserve component and for our active military forces.
Well, because then they're bringing all these National Guard troops. A lot of fellows, you know, really didn't intend ever to go overseas, didn't want to join the regular army, and suddenly they're deployed not once, but several times over there, totally disrupting their lives. Didn't that create some problems? And hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with General Sanchez. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lieutenant General Sanchez, Ricardo Sanchez, and of course his book is Wiser in Battle. He actually gave a speech last October. It's posted on our website, at least the last half of it, dealing with Iraq. It's posted on our website at RadioLiberty.com, the December 2007 newsletter. December 2007 newsletter at RadioLiberty.com. But General Sanchez was simply talking about the fact that the United States Army really does not have adequate troops to maintain a force over 130,000 there, and you kept trying to get the troops come in, additional troops, additional people in command positions, generals, colonels, things of that sort. They really immediately after the war, President Bush announced the war was over, they started pulling all the American troops out. They were going to leave you with 30,000 troops. And you knew that this was just going to be chaotic if you didn't have the adequate troops, didn't you?
Yes, sir. It was very quick. We were very quick to make that assessment once I took command. Within a matter of a week and a half, General Abizaid and I had had the discussion that we had to stop the redeployment of forces because we still had a war that we were fighting. And we also had a significant peacekeeping, if you will, or nation-building challenge that lay ahead. And we just could not afford to lose all those forces. As a matter of fact, we hadn't even occupied the country at that point in time yet, and we were already we already had units that were half redeployed into Kuwait and others that were standing down from their operations in the country.
Well, who's making this decision? Was this made at the Pentagon? Was this made by General Franks? Was this made by the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Who wants to pull all the military out of there when there's still a war going on?
Well, the decision, as I understood it, was made, it had to have been made by the President and the Secretary of Defense, but it was based on the recommendations of General Franks. When you make that level of a decision, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that it had the concurrence of the Secretary of Defense and the President.
And so here you're in command, and they take away all of your forces, and there's growing unrest among the population, and the beginning of a civil war, and you don't have the troops to fight it. What about the coalition forces? Are they willing to participate in active, a military engagement?
No, sir, part of the concept in the May time frame and part of the rationale for us pulling our forces out of there was that we would eventually get three coalition soldiers for every American that was in the country. Clearly, that was a very, very optimistic plan, and that really never materializes. We're not anywhere near that at any point in time, even though we have a significant number of nations. I think in the end, we total 36 nations that are there. The problem with them is that none of them come in with the ability to conduct offensive operations to reestablish security and order should some sort of incident arise. And the problem that we have beyond that is that we never are able to get them to conduct their missions within their sector, which is in the southern part of Iraq. And any time we have to conduct an offensive operation, I must reallocate my American forces to go down to the south.
So you've got all these coalition soldiers, but they're not about there. They're not there to fight. They're just there to maintain main order, like almost like a police force.
Well, I think it was a combination of things from their national perspectives and their national priorities and interests. Most of the nations do not want to be seen as occupiers and as aggressors within the country, and therefore part of the rationale for the 1 May declaration is that it was critical to increase coalition involvement, that we have an end to major combat operations, and that we had transitioned to phase 4, the stability and support part of this. The reality is that that never happens throughout the entire time we're there, and the coalition forces contribute significantly in stabilization, but in terms of security, when the times were really tough, it was problematic for us.
In other words, it was up to the Americans due to the fighting and the dying. What about the Brits? They were pretty good. Did they participate pretty well, the British?
Yes. The Brits pretty much maintained control of their sector in the Basra area, and the Italians also, when things get really tough, they do, in fact, respond and take care of their responsibilities. But I think what's important is that it's not the soldiers. It's just like for the American military, it winds up being political decisions that either allow them or do not allow them to take the actions necessary in their sectors.
Well, of course, my impression, reading your book, was that the soldiers really and the structure of the army under your command did a great job. It was just that time and time again you were frustrated by political decisions that kept you from winning the war.
Well, so that is in fact part of the challenge that we face when the nation goes to war. In fact, You know, war is an extension of politics, and for whatever reasons, there were significant points in time where we were not able to take advantage of the windows of opportunity that are provided by our military, and in fact, we're not allowed to execute military operations that our political leadership had specifically approved for us when they asked us to launch into these different endeavors, such as Fallujah and against Muqtada al-Sadr, because of political considerations.
Well, now, you actually had an opportunity, which you brought back, to meet with the president and meet with Rumsfeld on several occasions, or at least one occasion.
Yes, sir, I did, and that was when we were asked to come back to testify in front of Congress about the Abu Ghraib incident.
All right, fine. And Chris, really, of course, they were looking for a scapegoat as much as anything, weren't they, as far as this was concerned? You know, they had to come up with something, and of course, you were in command, and yet you weren't really in command, so much of it you had no control over at all.
Well, yes, sir. I think what happens is that, you know, we very quickly, at the institution level within the military and within the Department of Defense and the administration, we go into damage control mode and try to minimize as much as possible the exposure of the senior leadership. And I think to an extent my forced retirement is a reflection of that, where they're not willing to nominate me because it would resurface this very contentious issue within the Congress.
And of course, basically, this would have been, of course, for Lieutenant General Sanchez to have gotten his fourth star to become a full general. But of course, it was the decision as far as torture, as far as doing away with the restrictions of the Geneva Convention, was made at the highest levels of our government, which of course left you and the other military officers in a very difficult position. And yet, of course, you had actually given the command that you were going to obey the Geneva Convention, and the soldiers under your command were to abide by those international directives. Isn't that true?
So, absolutely. What the lack of guidance from Washington places individual interrogators and commanders on the ground in a very disadvantageous position, and really places the entire burden of decision making and oversight on those that are least capable of doing that in terms of developing policies and procedures and training and guidance, because they're fully engaged in battle. And you know, and what actually you know, happens to us is in Iraq is that you know, we make a very onerous effort at trying to bring some levels of control to the process of interrogations, and we issue the two memorandums that have been repeatedly highlighted as memorandums that open up the entire universe of abusive techniques, when in fact those memorandums are restricting the universe that existed before I issued them. And the results of the judicial investigation that was conducted in the aftermath of Abu Ghraib clearly established, and actually two investigations clearly established, that if those memorandums had been implemented as they were designed, they would have prevented abuses, because that was the intent.
And of course, if that is never really brought out, at least it's not brought out publicly, and although wasn't there this investigation eventually did exonerate you from any responsibility, didn't it?
Yes, sir. There are a couple of different investigations that do that. But of course, it's very, very difficult to change the conventional wisdom once it's been promulgated repeatedly in the media.
Well, of course, one of the things that you say, and you know, you've given your whole life to the military. You've been a good officer. You've advanced to the position of lieutenant general. And yet, of course, in the final analysis, why you were betrayed by the leadership, at least this was the feeling that I had.
Well, yes, sir. I felt that you know, I have been strung along for a series of years, from the 2004 to 2006, at least for 2 years, till the 31st of October of 2005, when I'm told that I have to retire. Because on multiple occasions, in my conversations with the senior leadership, I tell them that I'm willing to retire if that is what they want me to do or what the nation needs me to do, and repeatedly I'm told, no, we're going to get through this, and then in the end the decision is made that it's not convenient politically or militarily for anyone to at least the administration, to support an additional assignment for me.
And Chris, one of the remarks you make in your book is, you know, in the end, all you really have is your family and your friends.
Well, exactly, and you know, and I think that is a lesson for everyone. Is that you know, in the toughest of times, your positional friends, if you will, wind up deserting you, and your true friends come to the forefront, and your family and your faith are what you really. And those true friends are what you really have to turn to for support.
And of course, your book talks a great deal about your faith. You know, this idea, one of the Psalms you have, sort of as the basis for everything you believed in.
Yes, sir. Psalm 144. For at least the last 15 to 20 years of my time in service, was the bedrock of my faith. And you know, I've always been a man of tremendous faith, you know, I very quickly realized that the responsibilities that my nation and my army was investing in me were way beyond anything that I could personally handle without the assistance from a higher being.
Would you want to just quote, I know you know that by heart, the Psalm 144.
Yes, it would be, praise be to the Lord, my rock, who trains my fingers for battle and my hands for war.
And it's really brought up recurrently in the book. It really, of course, reiterates your faith. And really, I don't know how you could really be a military man without having faith. I mean, certainly, just the mechanics of war is a terrible thing. War is a terrible thing. But, of course, they have to be fought. But, of course, you have to have this belief that protects you. And many times, of course, your life's in danger. And yet you have to believe that God's going to see you through it.
Well, exactly. And I think... you know, I think when a soldier is preparing himself to go to war, he very quickly, whether in peacetime he reflects that faith in his daily life or not, sort of becomes irrelevant, because when you're prepared to cross the line of departure, if you will, when you're getting ready to attack or you're getting ready to face the enemy, our soldiers turn to that faith for the most part, and I think it is important, especially for leaders, to be able to seek that wisdom, that courage that comes from your faith.
Because this actually gives you an opportunity to actually express your faith to your soldiers as well, and on more, you've actually talked about these things to your soldiers as well, and at least those people are under your command.
Well, absolutely, and you know, I had some wonderful experiences over the course of my different commands. To be able to share that faith with my soldiers, and in one case, when I was during the Desert Storm time frame, because my chaplain was providing me what I called a thought for the day, it was a prayer, a short little prayer. It really spread like wildfire throughout my command, to the point where we were doing that even when we were attacking. During Desert Storm, and my soldiers expected to hear that every single day.
And I think really it's so important. I think from the point of view of the soldiers, know that the men who are leading them are all about men of faith.
Well, absolutely, and you know, it's that willingness to abide by our value systems, and having the strength of character to do what is right, and having the moral courage. To take care of your subordinates, your country, and to live by those values and that faith, and have the courage to stand up and express that to your subordinates is very, very important in your ability to lead.
Well, Chris, reading of course the book doesn't just deal with what happened in Iraq. It gives you your whole military career, and you were very much of a very strict as far as the training was concerned, because you knew that if the men weren't trained and they went into battle, why, of course, they would fail. And so you stressed the training so much, you know, before and during Iraq as well, didn't you?
Well, I had grown up with some great mentors or commanders that had made it made an impression indelibly in my mind that the greatest responsibility that we have as warriors is to make sure that your subordinates are trained for the tremendous difficulties of war. And it is our responsibility as leaders at all levels, from the national level down to the lowest young soldier, to make sure that you're properly trained and that your soldiers are trained before you send them into harm's way. And I believe that at times in the course of this war, we have not lived up to those standards at some levels of our command.
Well, Chris, sometimes you'd have soldiers sent over you from the States that really weren't trained and weren't ready to go into battle. Is that true?
Well, absolutely. That is true, and that is you know, one of the challenges, clearly, that I think America knows about is those military policemen and some of our interrogators. And then there is a whole series of other examples where we're making decisions as an army and as a country to deploy young soldiers into harm's way without properly training them, without properly transitioning them and equipping them so that they're prepared when they face the enemy. And that is something that we should never allow. And this is where, you know, I've made the comment in the past that moral courage was an uncommon virtue during this war, and there are multiple examples of where leaders did not have the courage to stand up for their soldiers.
And, of course, it's really it's a very, very touching book. Where can people get copies of your book, Wiser in Battle?
Well, the book can be found on Borders and Barnes & Nobles, and it can be found online also, sir.
It's a wonderful, wonderful book really, to really understand the situation that General Sanchez, but not only that, but our American military is. You know, they were very courageous, they fought well, but of course it was simply that the political decisions were made over and over again, where, of course, the defeat was snatched out of the jaws of victory. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up our program with Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. Well, General, we've got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. What are the thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners out across America?
Well, I think what's really important and the primary reason for my writing Wiser in Battle is to ensure that the political and the military leadership of America today really embraced what I believe were the lessons of that period. And then probably more important is that we need to go ahead and impart on our future leaders the tremendous difficulties that we face so that we don't go down this way again.
Well, I certainly had the feeling that if they just let the military, first of all, take care of Iraq after the war, instead of getting so concerned about, my goodness, somebody may have been a member of the Ba'athist Party, that we would not have been in the mess. We were over there and certainly shutting down the factories and shutting down the schools and some of the hospitals and, you know, not getting the police and the military and even the civil service. I mean, even today, here we are, what, 4 or 5 years after the war, and they still don't have electricity over there. This is madness. Isn't there tremendous resentment against the American forces on the part of many of the Iraqis? For at least they had a stable society, even though Sidney Saddam was a terrible, terrible guy, but at least they had electricity and water.
So that is exactly right. They really expected us to come in and be able to make some very significant changes very rapidly, and America was not prepared to do that. And our political, economic, and diplomatic capacities never were able to deliver. And to some extent, I think we could argue that today we still are not able to deliver at the levels that we should to achieve victory.
But don't you think that the military has just been able to do it? They're small people in the military. They know what to do. If they could use the infrastructure over there, we wouldn't be in the mess we were today.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely agree with that, and that is part of my assessment in the book, that the military is probably the only one that can achieve stability in the immediate aftermath of major combat operations. And for a period of about 18 months, 2 years, the military ought to be in charge of all aspects of the application of power in these types of operations.
In fact, we saw that at the Second World War in Germany. We saw it at the Second World War in Japan, where the military was given command and then eventually turned the authority over to the civilian. Why didn't we do that in Iraq? That's just it's so infuriating.
Well, it is, and You know, it was infuriating for those of us on the ground, but there were some political decisions that were being made that we still are not aware of as to why those decisions are made and why we allow this lack of unity of effort to exist, even when the reality and the circumstances on the ground are being very clearly communicated to Washington.
Well, God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us again, General. Thank you so much.
Okay, sir. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. I can say that if you really want to get the full text of what we said, remember we talked during the breaks, the commercial breaks, so if you'd like to get a copy of the tape or the CD of this program, they are available through Radio Liberty, and I think General Sanchez will certainly be a tape of the month selection. But it's vitally important, ladies and gentlemen, that you understand that what happened in Iraq did not have to happen. And, of course, it was Sidney Paul Bremer, who was a disciple of Henry Kissinger, who went over there, and in my estimation, this is my view and nobody else's, they intentionally destabilized the country, but the military could have done what was right and got the thing straightened out. They weren't allowed to. Let me suggest my little pamphlets, that we have a couple of them. One is, of course, called The True Story of 9-1-1, but it gets into some of these other issues. Go to our website and, of course, pull down the material we have up there on what's happened, certainly interviews with Tony Zinni, a four-star Marine General, Anthony Zinni. You can go on the Internet, Google in Radio Liberty Anthony Zinni and get his information. He was a four-star Marine General, was in charge over there of CENTCOM, and, of course, he will tell you we never should have gone into Iraq, and we shouldn't have. There was no reason to go into Iraq. Obviously, it was being our decisions were made for five different purposes. We didn't go in to win. We went there, of course, so we could keep our military there indefinitely. And we have no intention of pulling our forces out. And you must understand that this has all been fought for entirely different purposes than the American people have ever been allowed to know. Our forces are still starting and fighting in Afghanistan, and of course there's a resurgence of the Taliban being financed by the Pakistani intelligence service, being financed by the Pakistani army, being financed with your tax money. And, of course, they say, oh, well, the Taliban's getting a lot of their money from the drugs. Fine. Why don't we just destroy the drug crop? Oh, we couldn't do that. We couldn't spray all those poppy fields, you know, even though we control the country. Why would we antagonize the farmers there who are growing the deadly heroin that is killing so many people in Europe and here in the United States? And let me explain to you, ladies and gentlemen, these are all excuses. There is no war on drugs. If you haven't got our four tape set, is there a video war on drugs? You need to get that. You need to get the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. It tells you about Vietnam and how that was really fought so that the CIA could continue getting drugs out and bringing the drugs into the United States. And we have a book called Into the Buzzsaw, and one of the essays there is written by Gary Webb, who wrote extensively about the CIA and drugs. In fact, he's a gentleman who subsequently shot himself in the head twice to make sure he was dead. At least we're told it was a suicide, but it's the only suicide I ever know where somebody shot themselves in the head twice to make sure they were dead. You have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're up against organized evil, and when you understand that, when you understand the ultimate goal is a one-world government, a new world religion, and, of course, a new world leader, then it all begins to make sense. If you've not yet seen my talk on Iraq, the untold story, and the syllabus goes with that, we go into all the wars of the last century, because they were all fought to bring about a world government. And, of course, if you get my syllabus, you'll get the material about the project for the new American century, the new conservative organization that controls the government today, dedicated totally to the ideas of Machiavelli. Now, the website has been pulled down. Fortunately, we have the material there. It's all included in my syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story, a really great source of information, information you need if you want to help us in this truly spiritual battle for the survival of men's souls and the survival of Christian civilization. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464. I'm sorry, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. We have so many numbers in all the different programs we do, but 1-800-544-8927. You need to get my talk on the secret, the forbidden secret. That's the forbidden secret. My talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.